This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the Black economic condition has dramatically worsened in the 21st century, with median Black household wealth on a track to disappearing entirely in the next few decades. However, the author of a new book says there's not much that Black-owned banks can do to head off the disaster. And the nation's best-known political prisoner has been behind bars for 35 years, but his supporters are stepping up the campaign to bring Mumia home.
But first, Donald Trump's presidency has seen U.S. prestige in the world hit new lows. But the U.S. has long been regarded as having little respect for international law. Black Agenda Report contributor Danny Haifong has teamed up with Roberto Servent to author an upcoming book titled American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, The Fake News of Wall Street, White Supremacy and the U.S. War Machine. Haifong says Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were champions of American exceptionalism.
Figures like this in the Democratic Party were deployed to save American exceptionalism from the wholly unexceptional conditions that were produced by prior administrations, including the Democratic administration of Bill Clinton. So this whole notion of the politics of inclusion, the fact that a Black president could be elected and that women could be in political leadership, was meant to show people, especially Democratic voters who are very susceptible to this line of thinking, that indeed things were progressing even as quote-unquote mistakes were being made everywhere. And so now we have a situation where 8 years of the Obama period prior to Trump produced a complete exacerbation of all of the conditions that the Obama administration almost had a mandate to change, whether that was through the Affordable Care Act being a big sellout to pharmaceuticals and insurance corporations, whether that was the trillion-dollar bailouts to Wall Street, or whether that was increasing the military budget astronomically, including the biggest military deal with Israel that's ever been signed. All of these things have created a situation where the Democrats are in a state of crisis, a crisis of legitimacy that Tony Montero, Ajamo Baraka, I feel like, are always talking about, including yourself, Glenn, where the candidates that are being rolled out are just as obsessed with Russiagate as the rest of the mainstream Democratic political apparatuses, but also are trying to recycle this notion that a woman like Elizabeth Warren or a Black woman like Kamala Harris, right? I think even the New York Times said that maybe the United States is ready for a Black woman to be president now. They're trying to recycle this narrative of inclusion into the U.S. political apparatus as a way to distract from what these political figures are really all about, which is shilling for Wall Street, ensuring that the war machine continues unabated and expands through all corners of the globe, including the primary target of Russiagate, which is Russia. That's one of the biggest objectives of Russiagate that the Democratic Party sees, is that their military contractor partners, those that are really financing the party, they see Russia as a big threat to U.S. hegemony militarily. And they also see Russia as a country that has a lot to be desired and could be a real competitor on the economic stage, which scares the entire corporate state silly. So I think what we're seeing is a recycled politics of inclusion that's being promoted by the Democrats. And it's not going to work out in the same way, because Russiagate, on the other hand, shows that the Democrats are completely adverse to taking any stance or positions that most of their voting base actually wants them to take and actually wants them to implement. But we all know that things like universal health care or Medicare for all and free public education, we know those things are completely out of the realm of possibility when it comes to the Democratic Party.
Polls show that if you ask people the question, they have an opinion on alleged Russian meddling in U.S. electoral affairs. But a Gallup poll also showed that less than 1% of the public puts Russiagate at the top of their issues, that they think it's an important issue. Less than 1%.
Yes, and that's an important thing for the Democratic Party to take heed to, but we know that it won't, because the Democratic Party has no answers for the particular issues that people do care about. People really do care about this runaway capitalist system that is plundering the earth and plundering the world and impoverishing the great majority of people, both here in the United States and abroad. People really do care about that, but the Democratic Party is unwilling to address these issues. And what those polls show is that while most people in the United States really don't understand the political significance of Russiagate, right, they probably don't understand that there is this creeping war with Russia that potentially has nuclear capabilities that would be disastrous for humanity. They probably don't understand that the left and, you know, some quote unquote alternative sections of the right wing are being brutally suppressed by the surveillance regime as dictated by the Russiagate narrative. But they do understand that it really has no impact on their lives materially. So most people in the United States do not care about this hysteria over Russia, because none of it will produce a job, none of it will produce a higher wage, and none of it will produce affordable hair care or any other issue that really does impact the future of people in the United States economically and politically.
It also seems that hand in hand with Russiagate, which is a project of the corporate media, as well as the Democratic Party, as well as the intelligence agencies, that what goes hand in hand with Russiagate is an effort to limit or to delineate the left and the right, not based on economic issues or war and peace, but on so-called social issues, gay rights, for example, and prayer and other such issues.
Yes, the question of racism, for example, has been completely distorted by the Russiagate narrative. We have this almost pathological version of American exceptionalism that is being promoted by the Democrats, where, you know, Trump is seen as this moribund racist nut job, this big orange billionaire who is the most xenophobic character that's ever been produced by American politics. But on the other hand, Trump is compared with somebody like Putin, and they're seen as white nationalists looking to take over the world, when in fact, white nationalism is rooted in the American project, the American imperial project, and Trump is merely a manifestation of those roots. And in terms of these social issues, we know that these have been weaponized. Gay rights have been weaponized by NGOs that have gone into Russia to try to conduct regime change. That social issues, while they are important, cannot be divorced from the greater political and economic context from which they arise. And American exceptionalism, as the ideology of American empire, ultimately has infected and so distorted these issues, mostly because they are really being driven by the forces of Wall Street and the forces of the U.S. war machine rather than the people. Because most people, you know, on the ground, these issues were discussed, could logically understand that the United States is a racist country at its root. But what we see is the political apparatus, the intelligence agencies, as you said, the Democratic Party and Wall Street are all coalescing to use these issues as one of the many absurd bases of the Russiagate hysteria that continues to just completely suppress any political narrative that falls outside of the spooks in Washington or the U.S. military state or Wall Street generally, right? Like, there's no ability for, it's really tough for the Green Party or any other alternative political ideology and organization to make any impact, because we are being called Russians, in effect.
There's so much talk about a left resurgence in the Democratic Party, but in many ways, there seems to be less left in that party than there's ever been. We just saw the passage, the final passage, of a huge military spending measure, which was voted against by only 8 of the 40-plus members of the Congressional Black Caucus and by less than half of the so-called Progressive Caucus. Where is this resurgent left among the Democrats?
I think it's mostly in the minds. And I think that while the Democratic Socialists of America, who are running these campaigns of insurgent candidates, while they do take respectable positions on a lot of things, there is almost a fantasy that really needs to be unearthed and we need to be awoken from, which is that the Democratic Party is somehow going to be reformed into a progressive organization than it never was. I think that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez recently gave a speech where she said that the Democratic Party is the party of the Civil Rights Act and the party of the New Deal. And, you know, I would question that in one sense, that I understand where she's coming from. She wants to say that, yes, the Democratic Party has been in power during the times where these policies were enacted, but it probably makes more sense if we're talking about actually creating an alternative to the two-party duopoly and two-party corporate duopoly to understand that those legislative victories that really did improve the lives of many people were the result of struggle, struggle among masses of people, struggle among Black people, among working class people. That's where the struggle has always succeeded, and it's never succeeded in the two-party duopoly on its own. And so there is this myth that despite all evidence to the contrary, there can be a reform of the Democratic Party. And that's because at this time, the Democratic Party really is the stand-in party of American exceptionalism. I mean, Hillary Clinton said it herself during the 2016 campaign, the United States is already exceptional. It doesn't need to be made great again. That is sort of the line that the Democratic Party has taken, and it has used that line to justify its expansion of the military state, its complete subservience to Wall Street, and also its virulently and viciously racist policies in the realms of mass incarceration and policing and a whole host of other things, including immigration, that do not really get discussed when this quote unquote, you know, radical insurgency is speaking about the Democratic Party. It's all confined within it, and that's a problem.
The U.S. military offensive of the Obama administration seems to have succeeded in driving Russia and China much closer together, causing Russia to actually take a military stand against U.S.-backed jihadist rebels in Syria. And now we see that according to parity purchasing power, China's economy is now 25% bigger than the U.S. economy, leaving the U.S. behind.
Yes, and this is the future, honestly. This is the future of the global political economy generally. This marks the ultimate manifestation of what the decline of imperialism generally the system looks like, which includes the United States, Europe, and its junior partners. China and Russia are the future of the world in a lot of ways because they're the two countries big enough and with economies that are large enough to really forge an independent political and economic alternative to U.S. hegemony. And it's happening. And one of the reasons why the United States military is so desperate for war against these two countries is because it knows it. And it has stated in many different documents that these two countries represent the greatest threat to U.S. military supremacy in the world. And often that includes U.S. economic supremacy because the two are intimately related. So what we have is the Obama administration's foreign policy was all about ensuring that those two countries were contained. He called the pivot to Asia a containment strategy, and all of the NATO provocations that happened under his administration, as well as the sanctions, were all also about containing Russia's influence in the war in Syria is also a major point in this strategy. And Trump has disrupted that strategy because Trump doesn't really have any interest in it as an individual. And so what we've seen is that in order for Trump to differentiate himself from the two-party duopoly, he's had to take certain positions that have ultimately been part of the root of the whole Russiagate hysteria, which is they can't even, the Obama administration, the Republicans that were at his side, this big nasty tent that you spoke about, Glenn, in terms of the Hillary Clinton campaign, these forces cannot even take a position that deviates from the U.S. military state's line of containment of these two countries and ultimately of destroying them. So what we've seen is this Russiagate narrative come up as a defense mechanism to show that indeed Russia is a big, bad, evil country and that Trump is involved and that ultimately what needs to happen is that Trump needs to go and Russia ultimately needs to be destabilized. So we have this interesting conflict that just shows the decline of the system overall, and we really need to be aware of it.
In the real world, we're left with this deindustrialized shell of an economy and no respite from the rigors of such an economy from the Democrats or the Republicans. President Trump has proposed some kind of trillion-dollar reindustrialization, but there's no there, no real federal money, just a private fantasy. And the Democrats aren't really running on any kind of reindustrialization.
No, and all of this will come to a head. You know, Trump talked a big game during the election period in terms of appealing to certain stratum of folks who are struggling economically. But at the end of the day, reality sets in, and the fact that the U.S. political two-party duopoly is completely beholden to the interests of Wall Street becomes increasingly clear. I mean, we have a situation where, you know, most of the population in the United States, over 50%, cannot afford a $500 emergency. That means half of the country is dead broke. We also have a situation where Black people's wealth is going to equal zero in the next several decades, which indicates that most Black people in the United States are actually broke. And so this is going to come to a head because eventually this great disparity of wealth that exists in the United States and the world is going to lead to another economic crisis. And neither Trump nor the Democrats, there will be no force in Washington capable of addressing it. And that will hopefully lay the basis for another rebellion, hopefully larger than even the one we saw in 2011 with Occupy Wall Street, because I think that every subsequent crisis that happens after this will be even larger than the 2008 crisis.
But in the interim, the corporate media keeps telling us that there's no cause for rebellion or even discontent because the economy is booming and humming. And they point to what they call record unemployment. But of course, the jobs that are created are hardly jobs by previous definitions at all.
Right. And we know that over 80% of the jobs supposedly, quote unquote, created under the Obama period were actually low wage jobs or temporary jobs. So, yes, what we have is this mythical notion that the United States is progressing economically, that that crash in 2008 was an anomaly. And this follows the pattern of American exceptionalism in that one of the ways that American exceptionalism manifests itself is this idea that even when things are bad, even when there are negative implications to certain policies, that the overall trajectory of the United States economy, its political system, is in fact progressing. And so what we've had since the 2008 crisis is, despite all evidence to the contrary, despite the enormous debt that every working class person is living under, despite the completely enormous levels of poverty that most Black people are living under, despite stagnant wages, despite the fact that unemployment is completely an inaccurate measure, that somehow the capitalist economy is actually in recovery because, based on these inaccurate measures of unemployment, we have lower numbers than we did in 2008 when we still don't even have the same number of jobs that existed in 2008 that we do now. So there are these completely inaccurate measures and these narratives that have been concocted by the two-party political duopoly, especially the Democratic Party, which has been at the forefront of trying to take credit for an economic recovery that doesn't actually exist.
That was Black Agenda Report contributor Danny Haifong, co-author of the book American Exceptionalism and American Innocence.
Danny Haifong's co-author, Roberto Servent, is the editor of the Black Agenda Book Forum. Last week, the Bar Book Forum featured Mesra Baradaran, author of The Color of Money, Black Banks, and the Racial Wealth Gap. Baradaran is a law professor at the University of Georgia, specializing in banking law. She says black banks are useful and should be supported, but they're not the solution to black economic precariousness and the drastic decline of black household wealth.
I would recommend that everyone bank black, and I think that they are very useful in providing loans to, you know, black churches and black universities, and there's a lot of functions that they serve. But the reason that they're not the answer to the racial wealth gap is there is this long history that I try to uncover in the book, specifically in American politics, starting in during Reconstruction and again after the Civil Rights Movement. So in two of these really important moments where you're about to have meaningful reform, reparations, or some sort of actual economic justice program, you have the white political structure instead of black capitalism or black banking as an answer. You have seen, you know, organic black banks also. You know, there's grassroots, you know, and I try to cover those lots of times, you know, during Jim Crow. And so black banks develop during those eras, both in the North in the segregated communities and in the South in the Jim Crow era. So you have, you know, several different functions that black banks have served, but one of them, and the one that I want to point out, is this political decoy. And that is what I think my book is trying to explain is look, you have systems set up by the white government. Those were the levers of power. And to the exclusion of the black community that have built these this huge racial wealth gap. And it cannot be that that same white political structure says, once it's confronted with this history of injustice, well, okay, then you guys should just have more black banks and more black businesses and more capitalism to fix the thing that public policy created.
Yes, I can't tell you for how long black folks have heard other black people preaching that the black dollar makes black America, oh, something like the 10th largest market or
right.
economy in the world. And somehow there is salvation in pooling mm-hmm. those dollars.
Yes. And that goes back, you know, I've been looking into the original speeches of, you know, Booker T. Washington, that goes back to Marcus Garvey, that goes back to E. Franklin Frazier and Carter Woodson. You know, Carter Woodson in The Miseducation of the Negro, right after the Great Depression wiped out the black banks. I mean, he writes this book, I think, in 1936, maybe 39. And the nation's banking industry is devastated. And he explains, look, the reason our banks have failed is because you, black community, did not trust them. You have taken your money out of these banks and they have failed. And so this blaming of the black community where really the structure was, I mean, these banks were going to fail because the segregated black neighborhoods were going to be the first ones hit by the Great Depression. The New Deal was going to offer no help whatsoever. You know, and of course, Carter Woodson did not have the option of saying, okay, we're going to vote for someone who's going to cater to our needs, because there was no option. You know, so I understand the idea of self-help when the white political structure is against your best interests. But I think at this point, hopefully, we can demand more than just self-help. And I don't want to knock self-help because, sure, of course, that's great. But that is not the reason. That is not the reason for the racial wealth gap. And while I think there is a reason, you know, as far as like racial solidarity and protest to take money out of white banks and put them in black banks, so I'm all for that. But I think to fix the racial wealth gap, which was what I hope that we can do, then we need the federal government and the political establishment to understand that this was their creation and that it's their responsibility to fix.
Yes, suburbanization was possibly the biggest civil development, economic development, domestic development project that the world had ever seen. And the defunding yes. of the ghettos was part of that. How could some little black banking sector countervail such forces?
Absolutely. And you know, I think one of the questions I always get is like, well, what about Italian banks and Jewish banks and all these other immigrant banks? And I said, well, look, when the FHA created the golden era of American banking, and as you said, the white suburb, those groups were counted as white. Italians became white because of the New Deal and the GI Bill, the FHA and the GI Bill, Jews and all these other immigrant groups. You know, other immigrants weren't here yet, right? So there was a lot of immigrants who got cut in later. And there were some, of course, like Native Americans. I mean, their history is just colossal failure after failure of public policy. And there is a racial wealth gap there as well. But the black community deserves a special distinction among all these groups because the economic policy of the United States was built on first the exploitation of black labor and then the exclusion of black home ownership to create homogeneous white suburbs. So white wealth, you can say, came at the expense of black progress. And so that is a distinct thing. And it was created purposefully by a Congress that was controlled by a Southern minority that wasn't a majority, but it was a powerful block against any efforts to cut in blacks into the New Deal.
Bankers and capitalists in general are constantly attempting to inflate the value of their assets. And many people think we should see gentrification in that light. And yet, in a racist society, the very presence of black people on real estate deflates their market value. How can black bankers or black people pooling resources in any way countervail a capitalist ethos that sees the presence of blacks as diminishing the value of land and other property?
Absolutely. And you've just nailed the heart of the issue in today's economy is that the market deems black neighborhoods, which have black schools in them, as inferior to white neighborhoods that have predominantly white schools. So that is something that is a legacy of segregation, a legacy of the New Deal, a legacy of the creation of white wealth at the expense of black wealth. And so all of those things, your local taxes, your local school board, your local governance, all of those things are just perpetuating these different systems. And so when a neighborhood tips to black, as you said, those properties devalue. The schools get, quote unquote, bad, and whites flee, you know, and anyone who can leaves the neighborhood. And so it is not something that black banks can fix. It's not something that self-help can fix until we fix that, either our inherent racism and white supremacy or the structures that make those things possible and make those things market realities, like you said, right? The fact that if a school is majority black or even over a certain threshold of black, that white families feel like their child is unsafe in that school. And we actually don't even have to use the word race anymore. We just have to say, oh, this is a struggling school. This is a bad neighborhood. That school has behavior problems. You know, when I moved into this current neighborhood, it's a suburb, and the realtors will tell you these racially coded things. This neighborhood has a great school. You know, by what measure? Oh, the less behavior problems. And I'm looking at the stats, and you know, 99% white school. And then that other neighborhood, you know, there's behavior problems, et cetera. And so you hear this, and we really have to start pushing back at that racially coded language.
So rather than see gentrification as some kind of inevitability, we should be talking about ways to protect communities from gentrification, because that means protecting the inhabitants who would be moved out by this process.
Well, I mean, gentrification or not, like, I'm agnostic as to what black communities want to do with their own resources. That is not my position. What I want to say is communities need capital and wealth in order to build from within. No amount of spunk and savings from within and banking and grassroots efforts is going to fix it. We need capital. And in this day and age, in the 20th century, in the 21st century, politics and policies are responsible for credit and capital and corporate give outs versus, you know, welfare cut downs. It is that the structural things that happen in Congress and in the State House that determine what neighborhoods get the goods and what don't. And so, you know, fine, if you want to fight gentrification, if someone wants to push for integration, you know, I have met activists from all quarters. What you need is capital, and what you need is wealth to create more wealth. You cannot extract wealth from the ground. You need land, you need property, you need profitable businesses and jobs and all of that stuff. And there's several routes to get there. One of those routes is not self-help.
Well, there's so much talk about reindustrialization and rebuilding America, but neither the Democrats nor the Republicans talk about the creation of a public bank to take on that task, a bank with the capital to infuse in some of these targeted neighborhoods.
And I think you're exactly right. That's what's needed. I think there is some change on this front. I have myself been advising several candidates who are now considering proposing big projects related to public banking, related to guaranteed housing in these communities, related to real capital producing New Deal era things. And so I think that tide has begun to change. I am optimistic that the left, at least, is starting to understand that whatever has been going on, the left and the right have been playing the same game. And as far as creation of wealth for Black communities is concerned, and someone needs to figure out how to be a true progressive in this country. And there are a few, I think, green shoots coming up, and some older folks who I think are waking up to this as well, because we have not had a true progressive left, I guess, since Johnson, but I think Johnson was not as effective as he could have been if he, given his background and then being mired in Vietnam.
But okay. The remedy, you say quite clearly, must include a program of reparations.
Absolutely. And I think the devil is in the details. I mean, I think absolutely there needs to be a program of reparations. Everyone who's been committed to this has come around to this idea at one point or another. And I think the idea has shifted, you know, in the public thought. And I think we need to, first of all, not think of reparations as a crazy idea. I think we are now at the point where we can really, you know, sort of move the Overton window on this and understand that this is exactly the kind of program that we need. And so how do you, one obstacle is the theoretical justification for reparations. And I think previously it'd been talked about reparations for slavery. And I think I would bring that, the breach, closer to the present. Obviously, slavery was a huge breach, but there has been more recent breaches of the contract with Black America that we can address. The New Deal, the FHA, the GI Bill, the mass incarceration, all of these ways in which this continuous and continual segregation and abuse of these neighborhoods. And so I think it would be a more expansive project of reparations. And then really think about reparations the way we talked about the New Deal, where this is a social problem. This is not just about white versus Black. We all should commit to this idea because this was the main breach in the American contract. And I teach contracts, so everything I talk about is that, guys, but you know, this is where Martin Luther King goes, you know, in his I Have a Dream speech. I think we kind of focus on the, you know, content of my character part, but not on the part where he talks about Black America has been given a bad check. It has been marked insufficient funds. You know, he talks about the breach of that contract with Black America. And I think we need to talk about it in those terms again. This is, you know, all of these, you know, the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, the Civil Rights Act, all of these promises that have been made and continuously broken, there needs to be recompense. And when you break a contract, you have to pay damages. And you have to make the other person whole, make them right. And so this is what reparations look like. It is contract damages for broken promises. And I think also talking about it in a way that is not zero sum. Looking at the New Deal created wealth for every recipient of that FHA mortgage and the GI Bill, but there was no one else, there was no one left holding the bag. In other words, the wealth just got created and it came back in the pockets of all Americans, except for Black Americans, through increased tax revenue, through increased prosperity all around, jobs. That's how wealth creation works, is it does, you know, when you, you know, as opposed to trickle down economics, which was the Reagan plan, when you trickle up, when you bring up the bottom, when you remove pockets of poverty, when you remove segregation, when you remove mass incarceration, everyone is better off, not just morally and ethically, but actually financially. You know, so I don't think we have to see reparations as half of the population writing a check for the other half. What I would propose is that the government target, you know, that damages for the breach in a way that lifts, you know, and raises Black communities to where they should have been all along if the government policies had not been so discriminatory. And I think we will all be better off.
Well, we saw that Barack Obama, in his first 100 days in office, ruled out any special programs targeting Black communities.
He did. He did indeed. And I don't know why. I think he felt he could not be. I mean, he said, I'm not the president of Black America. I'm the president of the United States of America. And was it a political calculation? He knew he had to stay in office and he wasn't going to stay in office given all the racism. If he had tried to be, I can't speak for President Obama. I mean, I sure miss him now, but I was, you know, one of his biggest critics when he was in office. So I have mixed feelings about Barack Obama. I really think he blew it with the financial crisis bailout. That wiped out a lot of Black wealth, a lot of minority wealth, a lot of just wealth in general from the bottom. And what his administration did was to bail out the bankers and those at the top. And in a way, I think that was less Obama's doing than the people around him. But, you know, he picked a Treasury and he picked a Federal Reserve that was going to maintain the status quo. And he didn't, you know, to his defense, he didn't run on a populist, or he didn't run on a social economic equality platform. Yet I hoped, a lot of progressives hoped, that he would wake up and realize that he should have saved homeowners. He should have protected all the Americans from foreclosure as opposed to the banks from their revenues. And they didn't. And I think Donald Trump is the result of that failure.
If the cost of having a Black president is having one that won't do anything for Black people or for the rest of the Democratic base, then why have one?
You know, Booker T. Washington is the leader, the Black leader that the South could have handled, or maybe picked at the time. Because during his Atlanta speech, he talks about, you know, we're fine with segregation, we'll lift ourselves up. And you know, so Booker T. Washington was the leader that was chosen. And it's not as though another one could have survived that environment. So, it's, you know, sometimes I think about that with Barack Obama. Maybe he's the only leader that the white establishment could have tolerated. Maybe he was picked by them. But I think he was not, I do not think he was a cynical person. I think he himself was you know, trying to do his best. I just think he wasn't the leader that a lot of people wanted him to be.
We at Black Agenda Report have also compared Barack Obama to Booker T.
Okay,
and noted that it took 60-something years before that accommodationist legacy of Booker T could be shedded by the Black community with the Black rebellions of the 60s.
So I think some of the backlash to Obama that is public, I think, is good, especially from the Black community. I've loved to see this conversation growing and a real sort of groundswell of critique that I think is healthy for all of us. And I think Obama, I mean, maybe I'm just too much of a Pollyanna here, but I think the silver lining with Trump is that he has laid bare some of that racism that most white racists were too tactful to verbalize. And here we have a tactless, gross, bigoted president. You know, we have George Wallace. We had Nixon. And Nixon, I think, papered over some of Wallace's stuff. But maybe it would have been better to just have Wallace. Because what Nixon did is exactly what Wallace would have done. But I think Nixon felt better to the Republican establishment. And I think with Trump, we have a Wallace. And maybe that's good.
And of course, Nixon was a champion, a presidential champion of Black capitalism.
Yes, because Nixon wanted to oppose anything that had to do with civil rights, anything for the black community, and black capitalism was the way he could talk out of the front of his mouth to say, yes, we are doing something, and actually do nothing.
And Donald Trump is trying in some fits and starts to address black capitalism as well.
He and Steve Bannon last year instituted October as Black Business, Minority Business Enterprise Month. I mean, this is something that Nixon created, Reagan endorsed. Every October, they bring in black and brown businesses to the White House. They give them trophies, pat themselves on the back, and that is their civil rights agenda. He had a new deal with Black America that he rolled out on the campaign trail, and what it was tax cuts, more police, and credit for businesses. So it's Nixon's playbook.
That was Mesra Baradaran, author of The Color of Money, Black Banks, and the Racial Wealth Gap.
This month is known as Black August. Among many black activists, a month to remember political prisoners and those that have died in service to the liberation movement. Mumia Abu-Jamal has spent the last 35 years behind bars and the death of a Philadelphia policeman. Hearings resume on his contention that judicial bias led to his wrongful conviction. And Dr. Johanna Fernandez of the Campaign to Bring Mumia Home says there is photographic evidence of police tampering with evidence. Fernandez was part of the group that produced the 2010 film Justice on Trial, which has been screened on August 23rd at the Maisel Cinema in Harlem. She was interviewed by Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier.
We, the Justice on Trial team, we were preparing a film in part because I started teaching at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, which was not far from where Mumia was sitting on death row at SCI Green, which is the largest Supermax facility in Pennsylvania. And I started visiting with him, and he started calling into my class at Carnegie Mellon. And so I developed a relationship with Mumia. And that first live from death row conversation with my students was so powerful. It was the first time it had happened that I called my friend and said, we should make a film about this experience I'm having in the classroom. But then we heard that a black filmmaker well known in Philadelphia by the name of Tigray Hill was making a film about Mumia titled The Barrel of a Gun, which essentially argued that Mumia was a panther, panthers kill cops, and Mumia was guilty, literally. That was its argument, and it was supported by the Fraternal Order of Police and probably funded by it because its production quality is very, very high. So we decided that we were going to shift gears and essentially make a film that was going to challenge his, and we were going to screen it and premiere our film whenever he did. So we went on high gear to try to finish this film. So we went to work, raised an enormous amount of money to rent to the Constitution Center, and we screened it there. And so this was a very important move on our part because the fact that we were at the Constitution Center, he was at another comparable arts venue in Philadelphia whose name escapes me right now. And because we were premiering our films on the same day, this created a media spectacle. And our film got an enormous amount of attention. And this was all happening in the run-up to a decision that the then DA of Philadelphia was going to have to make about whether or not he was going to move forward and retry Mumia and resentence him to death, in part because at the same time that we were finishing the film, the Third Circuit Court which is a federal court, decided that Mumia's death sentence was acquired unconstitutionally. And so he was to go to spend life in prison without parole in general population and be taken off of death row. So that's the setting.
One of the individuals featured in the film who's not discussed very often is one Pedro Polakoff, a photographer who documented the crime scene back in 81. What is Polakoff's role in the film and in all of this, and why is it so important, his voice as regards this case?
So Pedro Polakoff is one of the main characters in the film. And as you mentioned, Pedro Polakoff was the first photojournalist at the crime scene. And he took photographs of what had happened, what had been left behind. And because the word on the street was that Mumia Abu-Jamal had killed Officer Faulkner, he assumed that Mumia was guilty, and he called the DA's office to give them the photos that he believed would unequivocally nail Mumia to death row. The DA's office never called him back. And so, fast forward approximately 30 years later, maybe 27 years later, 25. He is clearing out his basement. He finds the photographs, in part because one of the photographs had appeared in the newspapers, and someone from Germany, someone who's been studying the case in Germany, thought the photo was interesting. He hadn't seen it before, and he noted that it was Pedro Polakoff, who was the photographer. He finds Pedro Polakoff, who happens to be clearing out his basement. He finds the photos. The German professor comes to Philadelphia at the time to look at the photographs with him that he's never really looked at. They together study the photographs and realize that there had been tampering with evidence, and Pedro Polakoff had captured this unknowingly when he was photographing the crime scene. So those are the famous Polakoff photos, which no courtroom and no judge has examined. And the Polakoff photographs show explicitly the police cooking up the crime scene. And very important to note is that one of the police officers who testified in court said that he had properly handled the guns that were retrieved at the crime scene. And that same officer is seen holding both guns that were retrieved at the crime scene with his bare hands. And your listening audience should know that the former DA of Philadelphia, during one of the many scandals around police corruption and tampering with evidence to obtain a conviction, she told the newspapers that in order to make up for the scandal of police corruption, which has historically put so many innocent people in prison, if she found that even one police officer involved in a case has lied in court, she was going to throw out the case. And so part of what we need to tell the current DA of Philadelphia is that he should honor his predecessor's promise to the people of the city of Philadelphia, because we have proof that the cops lied and perjured themselves in court.
And speaking of that current DA of Philadelphia, Larry Krasner, that's the district attorney that would be presiding over Mumia's current case, wherein through Williams versus Pennsylvania and the precedent set by that case, Mumia is looking to have his appeals process renewed on account of judicial bias, specifically as regards one Ronald Castile. And the next hearing for that is coming up 1 week after this upcoming screening of Justice on Trial in Harlem. That hearing will be on August 30th. Can you give us some more information about any updates that might have occurred in this ongoing struggle for Mumia's appeals and why it is that there needs to be a mass convergence on Philly for that particular hearing?
This is a very important moment in Mumia's case, in part because, as you know, the issue of political prisoners is now being discussed in public discourse. There was an article in the Guardian newspaper in London that featured the 19 Black radicals who still remain behind bars in the United States, who were convicted essentially because of their activism during the Black Power movement. So there is now a tension on this issue of political imprisonment in the United States, in part because a number of political prisoners have been released, Black political prisoners. Seth Hayes was recently released, Debbie Africa of the MOVE organization and the MOVE 9, and others. And so we now have the possibility of opening up the conviction case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the most famous Black political prisoner in the United States, if not the world. And so if there is an opening in this case that is so famous and so well known, we can be assured that a number of other political prisoners are going to walk, because this case really is going to show the bankruptcy of the criminal justice system, not only around the imprisonment of Black radicals who were active during the 60s and their demonization, but also around the hyper-incarceration of Black people in the post-civil rights movement era and how exactly it was that the courts got away with it. So that's why people need to pay attention and come to the film screening, but also purchase tickets at the film screening to travel with us to Philadelphia on August 30th, where essentially a judge for over a year has been hearing from the prosecutor and from our attorneys on the issue of Williams versus Pennsylvania, which essentially is a Supreme Court case, the first of its kind, that established the parameters for bias on the part of a judge. Astonishingly, even though judicial bias is like our daily bread in the United States, the courts have never outlined the definition of judicial bias. Well, thankfully, the Supreme Court has finally gotten around to this important project. It's done so in this case, Williams versus Pennsylvania, which involves the same judge, Ronald Castile, who denied Mumia's appeals when Mumia presented his case in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. So for over a year, the previous DA gave the judge and Mumia's attorneys the runaround. And we thought that Krasner, the new DA, who's lauded as a progressive force in prosecution in Philadelphia, who set an example for the country, we thought that he was going to make good on the promise of justice and democracy that he upheld when he was running for office. But it seems that he's been pressured by the Fraternal Order of Police, and like every politician, he's caving in, and he's deciding to prosecute this issue like any other. And he's not He's not opening up the records, and he didn't find a document that the previous administration somehow lost, which is the document that we think will unequivocally show judicial bias, that the former DA turned judge, Ronald Castile, was involved in the prosecution of Mumia while he was DA of Philadelphia. Of course, this is all a charade, right? Because in any other case or in any other planet or in any other forum, you would look at the situation and say at face value, yes, Ronald Castile as DA must have been involved in the prosecution of the most important case in the history of Philadelphia, which was being prosecuted at the time that he was in office. And so when he became a judge, of course, he was going to deny Mumia's appeal because he had clearly prosecuted Mumia initially, so he wasn't going to essentially tell on himself as judge. In any case, that's the issue that's going to be heard again on August 30th. In the courts, and we need to send a clear message to the judge and the prosecution that it's time. It's time to bring Mumia home, and it's time to bring all of our political prisoners home. And in fact, it's time to end the wholesale incarceration of poor people, Black people, Latinos, in what is a money-making racket called the carceral state in the United States. Beyond it being a money-making racket, it's an extension of the oppression of Black people in this country from the beginning to the present.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.